Chapter 8. How Not to Die from Liver Diseases. There are some patients you never forget. On the first day of my GI rotation, GI stands for gastrointestinal, which means I was about to come face-to-face with any issues in the digestive tract from mouth to tush. I reported in, and I was told to go observe my team of senior doctors in one of the endoscopy rooms, where physicians use a scope to look into the GI tract for all manner of routine procedures. I expected to walk into a colonoscopy, looking at a rectal polyp, or maybe an upper endoscopy, looking at a stomach ulcer. But I'll never forget what I saw. It fuels me to this day in my mission to help people understand the connection between lifestyle and health, or lack of it. A sedated patient was lying on a gurney, surrounded by a team of doctors, using a scope with a camera. I looked at the monitor, trying to find anatomical landmarks to understand where the scope was. It was definitely down the throat, but the esophagus was snaked with what looked like throbbing varicose veins. They were everywhere. They looked like worms trying to emerge from under the smooth surface of the esophagus. Several had eroded through the lining and were spurting blood. I watched as more blood surged out with every one of the patient's heartbeats. She was basically bleeding to death into her stomach. The doctors tried desperately to cauterize and tie off these fountains of fresh red blood, but it was like playing a game of whack-a-mole. Every time one was cut off, another one sprung up. These were known as esophageal varices, veins swollen with backed-up blood due to a cirrhotic liver. Watching this nightmare unfold, I wondered how the patient first came down with cirrhosis. Was she an alcoholic? Did she contract hepatitis? I remember thinking how devastated she must have felt when she was told she had end-stage liver disease. How was her family coping? I was jerked back from my thoughts by screeching monitor alarm. She was bleeding out. The doctors couldn't transfuse blood faster than the patient was losing it internally. Her blood pressure fell and her heart stopped. The staff jumped into action with chest compressions, paddles delivering shocks and injections of adrenaline, but within minutes she was gone. It was my job to talk to the patient's family. I learned that her cirrhosis was not due to drinking too much or from being an IV drug user. Her liver had scarred over because she was obese and had developed a fatty liver. Everything I had just witnessed was preventable, a direct result of lifestyle choices. When people are overweight, they can suffer from social stigma, knee problems, and increased risk for metabolic disorders like diabetes, but this was the first person I saw bleed to death before my eyes. The family cried. I cried. I swore to myself I'd do whatever was necessary to help prevent this from ever happening to anyone under my care. You can make do with only one kidney. You can survive without a spleen or a gallbladder. You can even get by without a stomach, but you can't live without a liver, the body's largest internal organ. What exactly does the liver do? Up to 500 different functions have been attributed to this vital organ. First and foremost, it plays the role of bouncer, keeping unwanted guests out of your bloodstream. Whatever you absorb through your digestive tract isn't immediately circulated throughout your body. The blood from your intestines first goes straight to the liver, where nutrients are metabolized and toxins are neutralized. It's no surprise, then, that what you eat can and does play a critical role in liver health and disease. About 60,000 Americans die of liver disease every year, and the death rates have been rising each of the last 5 years. The incidence of liver cancer alone has been rising about 4% every year over the last decade. Liver dysfunction can run in families, like the iron overload disease hemochromatosis. It can be caused by infections that can lead to liver cancer, or it can stem from drugs, most often inadvertent or intentional overdoses of Tylenol. The most common causes, however, are drink and food, alcoholic liver disease, and fatty liver disease. Alcoholic liver disease. According to a famous series of papers in the Journal of the American Medical Association called The Actual Causes of Death in the United States, the leading killer of Americans in the year 2000 was tobacco, followed by diet and inactivity. The third leading killer, alcohol. About half of alcohol-related deaths were due to sudden causes, like motor vehicle accidents, but the other half were slower, and the leading cause was alcoholic liver disease. Excessive alcohol consumption can lead to an accumulation of fat in the liver, what's known as fatty liver, which can cause inflammation and result in liver scarring and eventually liver failure. The CDC defines excessive drinking as the regular consumption of more than one drink a day for women and more than two a day for men. A drink is defined as 12 ounces of beer, 8 ounces of malt liquor, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces or a shot of hard liquor. Progression of the disease can usually be halted by stopping drinking, but sometimes it's too late. Heavy alcohol consumption can cause a fatty liver in less than 3 weeks, but it usually resolves within 4 to 6 weeks after stopping drinking. But in 5 to 15% of cases, the disease continues to progress and the liver starts to scar despite alcohol cessation. Similarly, once alcohol-induced hepatitis, liver inflammation, is diagnosed, 3-year survival rates can be as high as 90% among those people who stop drinking after diagnosis, but as many as 18% of them go on to develop cirrhosis, an irreparable scarring of the liver. The best strategy to avoid alcoholic liver disease is to not drink so much in the first place. But if you do drink excessively, help is available. Though most people who drink may not be alcoholics, there is convincing evidence that 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous can be effective for those who do suffer from alcohol dependence. A side note, isn't moderate drinking beneficial? Everyone agrees that heavy drinking, drinking during pregnancy, and binge drinking are bad ideas. But what about moderate drinking? Yes, excessive drinkers appear to significantly shorten their lives, but so can teetotalers. While smoking is bad for you and smoking a lot is worse, that logic may not hold for alcohol consumption. There appears to be a beneficial effect on overall mortality by drinking some alcohol, but only, it seems, for those who are not taking good care of themselves already. Moderate drinking does appear to protect against heart disease, perhaps because of a blood-thinning effect, but even light drinking, less than one drink a day, was found to increase cancer risk, as you'll hear in Chapter 11. How could something that increases cancer risk still prolong life? Well, cancer is only our second leading killer disease. Because heart disease is the leading cause of death, it explains why people who drink moderately may live longer lives than those who abstain. But this advantage may be restricted only to those who fail to practice a bare modicum of healthy behaviors. To find out who might benefit from moderate alcohol consumption, researchers recruited close to 10,000 men and women and followed them for 17 years after assessing their drinking and lifestyle habits. The results were published in a paper entitled, "Who Benefits Most from the Cardioprotective Properties of Alcohol Consumption? Health Freaks or Couch Potatoes?" What constituted a quote-unquote health freak? Well, according to the researcher's definition, anyone who exercised 30 minutes a day, didn't smoke, and ate a minimum of one serving of fruits or vegetables daily was a so-called health freak. What does that say about our current diets if eating a single apple means you're a health freak? 1 to 2 drinks a day did lower the risk of heart disease for the so-called couch potatoes, those living unhealthy lifestyles. But people who practice even the bare minimum of healthy behaviors showed no benefit from alcohol. The lesson? Grapes, barley, and potatoes are best eaten in their non-distilled form, and Johnny Walker is no substitute for actual walking. Non-alcoholic liver disease. The most common cause of fatty liver is not alcohol, but non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. You may remember the blockbuster documentary Supersize Me, in which the film's director, Morgan Spurlock, ate exclusively at McDonald's for a month. Predictably, Spurlock's weight, blood pressure, and cholesterol all went up, but so did his liver enzymes. That was a sign that his liver cells were dying and spilling their contents into the bloodstream. How was his diet causing liver damage? Let's put it this way. He was beginning to turn his liver into human foie gras, fatty liver pate. Some critics wrote off the film as overly sensational, but researchers in Sweden took it serious enough to formally replicate Spurlock's one-man experiment. In their study, a group of men and women agreed to eat 2 fast food meals a day. At the start, their liver enzyme levels were normal, but after just 1 week of this diet, more than 75% of the volunteers' liver function test results became pathological. If an unhealthy diet can cause liver damage within just 7 days, it should be no surprise that non-alcoholic fatty liver disease has quietly become the most common cause of chronic liver disease in the United States, afflicting an estimated 70 million people. That's about 1 in 3 adults. Nearly 100% of those with severe obesity may be affected. Like alcoholic fatty liver, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease starts with a buildup of fat deposits in the liver that cause no symptoms. In rare cases, this can progress to inflammation and over years end up scarring the liver into a state of cirrhosis, resulting in liver cancer, liver failure, or even death, as I saw in the endoscopy suite. Fast food is so effective at instigating the disease because non-alcoholic fatty liver is associated with the intake of soft drinks and meat. Drinking just 1 can of soda a day appears to raise the odds of getting fatty liver disease by 45%. Meanwhile, those who eat the meat equivalent of 14 chicken nuggets or more daily have nearly triple the rate of fatty liver disease compared to people who eat 7 nuggets worth or less. Non-alcoholic fatty liver has been characterized as a tale of fat and sugar, but not all fat affects the liver similarly. People suffering from fatty liver inflammation were found to be consuming more animal fat and cholesterol, but less plant fat and less fiber and antioxidants. This may explain why adherence to a Mediterranean-style diet with plenty of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and beans has been associated with less severe fatty liver disease, even though it's not typically a low-fat diet. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease may also be caused by cholesterol overload. The dietary cholesterol found in eggs, meat, and dairy can become oxidized and set off a chain reaction that results in excess fat in the liver. When the concentration of cholesterol in your liver cells gets too high, it can crystallize like rock candy and result in inflammation. This process is similar to the way uric acid crystals cause gout, as you'll hear about in Chapter 10. Your white blood cells try to engulf the cholesterol crystals, but then die in the process, spilling out inflammatory compounds. This may explain how benign fatty liver cases can turn into serious hepatitis. To explore the relationship between diet and serious liver disease, about 9,000 American adults were studied for 13 years. The researchers noted that their most important finding may be that cholesterol consumption was a strong predictor of cirrhosis and liver cancer. Those consuming the amount of cholesterol found in, like, 2 Egg McMuffins or more each day appeared to double their risk of hospitalization or death. Your best bet for avoiding non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, the most common cause of liver disease, may be to avoid excess calories, cholesterol, saturated fat, and sugar. Viral hepatitis. Another common cause of liver disease is viral hepatitis, which is triggered by one or more of 5 different viruses, hepatitis A, B, C, D, or E. The mode of transmission and prognosis differs for each of these viruses. Hepatitis A is spread primarily through food or water that's tainted with contaminated feces. It can be prevented through vaccination, avoiding raw and undercooked shellfish, and trying to ensure that everyone who handles your food washes their hands after changing diapers or using the toilet. While hepatitis A virus is foodborne, hepatitis B virus is bloodborne and is transmitted sexually as well. As with hepatitis A, an effective vaccine is available against hepatitis B that every child should get. Hepatitis D virus infection can only occur in someone who's already infected with hepatitis B, and so can be prevented by preventing hepatitis B. So get vaccinated and refrain from intravenous drug use and unsafe sex. Unfortunately, there is currently no vaccine for the hepatitis C virus, the most dreaded of liver viruses. Exposure can lead to chronic infection that, over decades, can lead to cirrhosis and liver failure. Hepatitis C is now the leading cause of liver transplants. A side note on chlorella and hepatitis C. The green algae chlorella looks promising for the treatment of hepatitis C. A randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study found that about 2 teaspoons a day of chlorella boosted the activity of natural killer cells in participants' bodies, which can naturally kill hepatitis C-infected cells. A clinical study of hepatitis C patients found that chlorella supplementation may lower the level of liver inflammation, but the study was small and uncontrolled. There's a desperate need for alternative treatments for hepatitis C, as older, less expensive therapies frequently fail due to their unbearable side effects, whereas newer, more tolerable drugs cost as much as $1,000 per pill. Chlorella may help as an adjunct or additional therapy, or for those who can't tolerate or afford conventional antiviral therapy, but may not be without risk. Hepatitis C is transmitted via blood, usually through sharing needles rather than via blood transfusions, now that the blood supply is screened for the virus. However, sharing personal care items that can be contaminated with trace amounts of blood, such as toothbrushes and razors, may also present a risk. Although a case was once reported involving a woman who contracted hepatitis C from sharing a supermarket meat slicer with an infected coworker, the virus would not naturally be present in the meat itself, as humans and chimpanzees are the only animals who appear susceptible to it. The same cannot be said, though, for hepatitis E virus. Preventing hepatitis E through diet. As one of the CDC's Division of Viral Hepatitis Laboratory chiefs explained in a paper entitled "Much Meat, Much Malady: Changing Perceptions of the Epidemiology of Hepatitis E," hepatitis E virus is now considered a zoonotic disease, able to spread from animals to humans, and pigs may be the primary viral reservoir. The shift in thinking began in 2003 when researchers in Japan linked the hepatitis E virus with the consumption of grilled pork liver. After testing pork livers from Japanese grocery stores, the researchers determined that nearly 2% of the meat tested positive for HEV, hepatitis E virus. In the United States, it may be even worse, 11% of commercial pig livers purchased from grocery stores were contaminated with HEV. That's alarming, but how many people really eat pig livers? What about plain old pork? Unfortunately, pork may harbor HEV as well. Experts suspect that much of the American population has been exposed to this virus, as there is known to be a relatively high prevalence of HEV antibodies among U.S. blood donors. This exposure may be a result of individuals consuming HEV-contaminated pork. So, do more people die of liver disease in countries where pork is more popular? It appears so. The relationship between national per capita pork consumption and deaths from liver disease correlates as tightly as per capita alcohol consumption and liver fatalities. Each pork chop consumed per capita may be associated with about 2 beers worth of increased liver mortality risk on a countrywide scale. Aren't viruses deactivated by cooking? Usually, but there's always the problem of cross-contaminating your hands or kitchen surfaces while handling raw meat. Once meat is in the oven, most foodborne pathogens can be destroyed by cooking the meat to the proper internal temperatures, with an emphasis on proper. Researchers at the National Institutes of Health subjected the hepatitis E virus to various levels of heat and found that HEV can survive the internal temperature of meat cooked rare. So if you cook pork, invest in a meat thermometer and make sure to follow proper handling techniques, including washing kitchen surfaces with a bleach solution. Though most people who develop hepatitis E recover completely, it can be deadly for pregnant women. The risk of death during the third trimester can be as high as 30%. If you're pregnant, please be especially careful about pork preparation. And if there are people in the household who like their pork pink in the middle, they should be sure to wash their hands thoroughly after using the bathroom. A side note on weight loss supplements and liver disease. We've all seen those marketing schemes involving products espousing all sorts of health claims, and given the pyramid-like multi-level structure of these types of distribution programs, you know, you earn more money by selling products and also for recruiting others to sell, word can spread pretty fast, which is particularly troubling when PR outruns the truth. Indeed, while the vast majority of drug-induced liver injuries are caused by conventional medications, liver damage caused by certain classes of dietary supplements can be even more serious and may lead to higher rates of liver transplants and death. Multi-level marketers of products later linked to toxic reactions, such as and Noni Juice and Herbalife have pointed to scientific studies to support their health claims. However, a public health researcher found that such studies often seemed, quote, deliberately created for marketing purposes, unquote, and were presented in such a way as to appear designed to mislead potential consumers. Often, multi-level marketing study researchers didn't disclose their funding sources, but a little detective work can expose a web of financial conflicts of interest. These suspect studies were the same ones cited to provide proof of safety for their products. For example, a multi-level marketing company that sells mangosteen juice cited a study they paid for to support its assertion that their product is safe for everyone. The study involved exposing just 30 people to their product, with another 10 given a placebo. So, with so few people tested, the stuff could literally kill 1% or 2% of users, and you just wouldn't know. A study that the multi-level marketing company behind the supplement called Metabolife cited for safety placed 35 people on the stuff. Metabolife has since been withdrawn from the market after being linked to heart attacks, strokes, seizures, and deaths. Hydroxycitric acid, a component of such products as Hydroxycut, was studied on 40 people. No serious adverse effects were found, but the story ended the same way. Hydroxycut was withdrawn after dozens of verified cases of organ damage were brought to light, including massive liver failure requiring transplantation and even death. Until the multi-billion dollar herbal supplement industry is better regulated, you're better off saving your money and your health by sticking to real food. Protecting the liver at breakfast. Specific plant foods have been found to be protective of the liver. For instance, starting out the day with a bowl of oatmeal and, surprisingly, coffee may help safeguard our liver function. Oatmeal. In numerous population studies, consumption of whole grains has been associated with reduced risk for a range of chronic diseases, but it's hard to tease out whether eating whole grains may just be a marker for a healthier lifestyle in general. For example, people who eat whole grains, such as oatmeal, whole wheat, brown rice, also tend to be more physically active, smoke less, eat more fruits, vegetables, and dietary fiber than those who might prefer a breakfast of Fruit Loops, for example. No wonder the former group may have lower disease risk. Fortunately, researchers can control for these factors, effectively comparing non-smokers only to non-smokers with similar diet and exercise habits, and when that's done, whole grains still appear to be protective. In other words, the evidence seems clear that oatmeal eaters may have lower rates of disease. But that's not the same thing as showing that if you start eating more oatmeal, your risk will drop. To prove cause and effect, we need to put it to the test by performing an interventional trial, change people's diets, and see what happens. Ideally, researchers would randomly split people into two groups and give half of them oatmeal and the other half a placebo, a fake similar-tasting and looking oatmeal. Neither the study subjects nor the researchers themselves can know who's in which group until the end. This robust double-blind method is easy to use when studying drugs, as you can give people a sugar pill that looks like the drug in question, but as we've discussed, it's not as easy to make placebo food. But in 2013, a group of researchers published the first double-blinded, randomized, placebo-controlled trial of oatmeal in overweight men and women. They found a significant reduction in liver inflammation in the real oatmeal group, but that may have just been because they lost so much more weight than the controls, versus the placebo oatmeal eaters. Nearly 90% of the real oatmeal-treated subjects had lost weight, compared to no weight loss on average among the control group. So it may be that the benefits of whole grains on liver function are kind of indirect. A follow-up study in 2014 helped confirm the findings of a protective role of whole grains in non-alcoholic fatty liver patients in reducing the risk of liver inflammation. In this study, refined grain consumption was associated with an increased risk of disease, though. So lay off the Wonder Bread and stick to truly wonderful whole grain foods, including oatmeal. A side note on making your own whole cranberry cocktail. A specific class of plant compounds called anthocyanins, the purple, red, and blue pigments in such plants as berries, grapes, plums, red cabbage, red onions, have been found to prevent fat accumulation in human liver cells in vitro studies. A single confirmatory clinical, meaning human trial, has been published in which a purple sweet potato concoction successfully dampened liver inflammation better than placebo. When it came to suppressing the growth of human liver cancer cells in a petri dish, cranberries beat out the other most common fruits in the United States: apples, bananas, grapefruits, grapes, lemons, oranges, peaches, pears, pineapple, and strawberries. Other studies have found that cranberries are also effective in vitro against additional cancers, including those of the brain, breast, lung, colon, mouth, ovary, prostate, and stomach. Unfortunately, there have yet been clinical studies of the effects of cranberries on cancer patients to confirm these findings. Moreover, to the drug industry's chagrin, scientists have been unable to pin down the active ingredients involved in the cranberry's special effects. Extracts concentrating individual components fail to match the anti-cancer effects of the cranberry as a whole, which of course can't be patented. More proof that it's nearly always best to give preference to whole foods. But how do you do that with cranberries, though, since they're so tart? It's not easy at the grocery store. 95% of cranberries are sold in the form of processed products, such as juices and sauces. In fact, to get the same amount of anthocyanins found in a single cup of fresh or frozen cranberries, you'd have to drink 16 cups of cranberry juice cocktail, eat 7 cups of dried cranberries, or make your way through 26 cans of cranberry sauce. The ruby red phytonutrient found in cranberries is a powerful antioxidant, but the high fructose corn syrup added to cranberry cocktail acts as a prooxidant, canceling out some of the benefit. Here's a simple recipe for a whole food version of a tasty cranberry beverage, which I call my pink juice. It involves just placing in a blender together a handful of fresh or frozen cranberries, 2 cups of water, and 8 teaspoons of erythritol, which is a naturally derived low-calorie sweetener, which I'll talk about more in Part 2. Place all those ingredients in a blender, blend at high speed, pour over ice, and serve. At just 12 calories, this recipe has 24 times fewer calories and at least 8 times more phytonutrients than typical cranberry juice drinks. For an extra boost, blend in some fresh mint leaves. You'll get a weird-looking green foam on top, but not only will it taste good, you'll be happy to know you're chugging down berries and dark leafy greens, 2 of the healthiest foods on the planet. Bottoms up. Coffee. Back in 1986, a group of Norwegian researchers came across an unexpected finding. Alcohol consumption was associated with liver inflammation, no surprise there. But coffee consumption was associated with less liver inflammation. These results were replicated in subsequent studies performed around the world. In the United States, a study was done with people at high risk for liver disease, for example, those who were overweight or drank too much alcohol. Subjects who drank more than 2 cups of coffee a day appeared to have less than half the risk of developing chronic liver problems as those who drank less than 1 cup. What about liver cancer, one of the most feared complications of chronic liver inflammation? It is now the 3rd leading cause of cancer-related death, an upsurge driven largely by increases in hepatitis C infections and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. The news is good. A 2013 review of the best studies to date found that people who drank the most coffee had half the risk of liver cancer compared to those who drank the least. A subsequent study found that the consumption of 4 or more cups of coffee a day was associated with a 92% lower risk among smokers dying from chronic liver disease. Of course, quitting smoking would have helped as well. Smoking may multiply by as much as tenfold the odds of those with hepatitis C dying from liver cancer. Similarly, heavy alcohol drinkers who consume more than 4 cups of coffee per day appear to reduce their risk of liver inflammation, but not by nearly as much as people who cut down on alcohol. Liver cancers are among the most avoidable cancers through hepatitis B vaccination, control of hepatitis C transmission, and reduction of alcohol consumption. These 3 measures could, in principle, wipe out 90% of liver cancers worldwide. It remains unclear whether coffee drinking has an additional role to play, but such a role would be limited compared with preventing liver damage in the first place. But what if you're already infected with hepatitis C or among the nearly 1 in 3 American adults with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Until relatively recently, no clinical trials had put coffee to the test, but in 2013, researchers published a study in which 40 patients with chronic hepatitis C were placed into 2 groups. The first group consumed 4 cups of coffee daily for a month, while the second group drank no coffee at all. After 30 days, the groups switched. Of course, 2 months is not long enough to detect changes in cancer outcomes, but during that time, researchers were able to demonstrate that coffee consumption may reduce DNA damage, increase the clearance of virus-infected cells, and slow the scarring process. These results help explain the role coffee appears to play in reducing the risk of liver disease progression. A commentary in the journal Gastroenterology entitled, "Is it Time to Write a Prescription for Coffee?" explored the pros and cons. Some insist that we must first identify the active ingredient in coffee beans that's protective. After all, there's more than 1,000 different compounds have been found in coffee. More studies are needed, but meanwhile, moderate daily ingestion of unsweetened coffee should be considered a reasonable adjunct to medical therapy for people at high risk for liver damage, such as those with fatty liver disease. Keep in mind that daily consumption of caffeinated beverages can lead to physical dependence, and caffeine withdrawal symptoms can include days of headache, fatigue, difficulty concentrating, mood disturbances. Ironically, coffee's tendency to be habit-forming could turn out to be a good thing. If the liver health benefits are confirmed, then daily consumption may ultimately prove to be an advantage. With liver disease, as always, prevention is the key. All the most serious liver conditions, liver cancer, liver failure, and cirrhosis, can start with an inflamed liver. That inflammation can be caused by an infection or the buildup of fatty deposits. Liver viruses can be prevented by common sense measures. Don't inject drugs, do get vaccinated, do practice safe sex. Liver fat can also be prevented by common sense measures. Avoid excess consumption of alcohol, calories, cholesterol, saturated fat, and sugar.